This is Radio Health Journal, a weekly news magazine with the latest in health, medicine, and technology. I'm Shel Lustig.
I'm Nancy Benson.
And I'm Reed Pence. This week, COVID fears and the Zoom Thanksgiving.
As bad as it is now, I think our fear is that it could get a lot worse. If we wait, things may be completely out of hand, and then it will be far harder to get things back under control.
Then, flat head syndrome and what parents of babies can do about it.
We saw many, many more cases after pediatricians instructed parents to put their kids on the back of their heads.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Supporting immune function through a healthy diet has become an important new focus for many people these days. One key recommendation is to eat more vegetables and fruits, such as grapes, every day to improve immune function. Combining grapes with vegetables can help achieve this goal in a tasty way, according to registered dietitian Courtney Romano, health advisor for the California Table Grape Commission.
Fresh grapes are heart healthy and hydrating and linked to benefits in multiple areas of health, including supporting immune function. Grapes are always a smart snack choice on their own, and they also pair well with other healthy foods such as vegetables to enhance flavor and nutrition. Add grapes to a kale, spinach, or arugula salad. Roast grapes with cauliflower or broccoli. Combine grapes with cucumbers and feta for delicious and healthful eating.
Grapes from California are a natural source of antioxidants and other polyphenols. Visit grapesfromcalifornia.com for more information and over 300 recipes.
American legend has it that the first Thanksgiving was celebrated by the Pilgrims in 1621. President Abraham Lincoln declared it a national holiday in 1863, in the middle of the Civil War, saying, despite everything, we still had a lot to be thankful for. Only a few times since then have we needed reasons to feel thankful as much as we do in 2020.
It is a hard thing right now, and I think just we need to acknowledge that for people, that we are dealing with a hard time. And some of us have the resources to handle it better than others, I think.
Dr. Beth Thielen is assistant professor of pediatric infectious diseases and immunology at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a pediatric infectious disease physician with mHealth Fairview Health System. She says while we all probably need the warmth of family and friends about now, this unfortunately needs to be the year of the Zoom Thanksgiving. All you have to do is look at the COVID numbers.
We are heading to a place where things are likely to get substantially worse. And I think that is the fear that is driving myself and my colleagues as we see the numbers, we see the hospitalizations going up in our cities. And even though we do have better tools for caring for people who are sick, there are still limits to what our health systems can handle. And I think as bad as it is now, I think our fear is that it could get a lot worse. And we can either choose to take precautions now, or if we wait, things may be completely out of hand, and then it will be far, far harder to get things back under control.
That will require us to do things people don't really want to do, like wear a mask and make hard, unpopular decisions that we might have avoided with better mask adherence. If we don't, forecast models project a total of around 400,000 deaths by February 1st. But it's already too late in some sense. Even if virtually everyone starts wearing a mask right now, those models still project a death toll of nearly 340,000 by February. And Thielen says we may not be able to keep the essentials running.
We can take proactive action now that we may help get spread under control. We hopefully, can maintain some kind of schooling situation. We can really prioritize the most vital services. So having children in school, I think certainly is something that we would ideally like to prioritize. It's hard decisions. Nobody wants to cancel sporting events and close bars and restaurants, but I think those things may be key to getting this sort of to a manageable level where we can still have some basic services going on.
Another basic service that's in danger is healthcare. Hospital beds are filling up, and it's likely only to get worse.
Typically, hospitalizations and deaths come up several weeks after the spike in cases. So I'm very concerned about the direction things are heading in. And there is a limit in terms of staffing for the hospitals. I think often we think about the ventilators and the beds, but really that's only a part of hospital care. A really big part is the human capital, the doctors, the nurses, the respiratory therapists that are taking care of these people. And when a good chunk of your healthcare workforce is out sick because they have been infected by COVID, that creates a really big problem for taking care of sick patients. And I don't want us to get to the point where we are unable to care for sick people because we literally do not have the resources to do so. And I'm very worried that that could happen.
That's why public health experts have also been pleading for people to get a flu shot this year. The flu hospitalizes people too, and every bed taken up by influenza is one that's not available to a COVID patient. Our annual experience with the flu and other respiratory illnesses also allowed experts to predict pretty surely that we'd have a big spike in COVID cases in the fall.
Those infections have a very predictable season pattern that they tend to come around in the winter season in the temperate climate. And so there's certain risk factors that we know that make those diseases spike in the winter. And so it tends to be the cold weather, people are indoors, they're in close proximity to each other. So those are the same sort of risk factors that potentially allow for the spread of COVID. I think we didn't perhaps anticipate the extent to which sort of the COVID fatigue has set in, that I think people are hearing, you know, widely that people are very tired of the precautions. They want to go back to normal life. They want to eat in restaurants and go to sporting events and see friends and family again. And I think those factors are also really playing into why we're seeing the spike in cases now.
COVID fatigue means that a lot of people just can't do it anymore. The mask wearing, physical distancing, and other steps that have helped to keep infection rates down early in the pandemic.
Certainly early on in March and April and May, I think, you know, all the restaurants were closed. Everybody was very much hunkered down, and so those things weren't happening. And I think people were, you know, afraid. I think they were, you know, trying to... I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty and there was a lot of early reports of severe illness. So I think people were sort of taking a bit more precautions at that point in time. And I think what I've, you know, increasingly seen is people are sort of tiring of that and wanting to get together. And I think there's a mix of ways that this is spreading. So certainly I think these small group gatherings are part of the problem, but we're seeing outbreaks at events like churches and, you know, in funerals, weddings, gyms. All of these sites have had outbreaks, and I think reasonable consensus in the scientific community that masks, while not potentially perfectly effective, can substantially reduce the risk of spread. And I think that there's been some slowness to adopt all of those precautions.
So as COVID positive rates rise, more states are putting in restrictions again. Among those to feel the pinch first are bars and restaurants, with capacity limits in many states and a prohibition from serving customers inside at all in a few. Experts say there's a reason for the restrictions. First and foremost, when you're eating and drinking, you can't wear a mask.
When you have a lot of people in a space and the people are generating a lot of respiratory particles by talking loudly and laughing and having fun, and they're not wearing masks, and then the indoor environment probably is not very well ventilated, and when you add all those things up, and then it just so happens that a person shows up in the space that's asymptomatic and infectious, then you have a situation that is prone to an outbreak.
That's Dr. Shelley Miller, an indoor air expert and professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Colorado. She says one way to think of how the COVID virus acts in an indoor space, like a bar, is to imagine cigarette smoke.
If you're in a bar or in a restaurant that allows smoking, and there's nobody smoking in there to begin with, but then a person comes in and starts smoking, if you're close to the person, you immediately notice and can start to see this cloud of smoke being released. If you're farther away, it takes a little bit longer for that smoke to be dispersed and then to reach you, but eventually you do smell it and you do say, oh, there's somebody smoking in here. And then it can build up over time, especially if you don't have good outside air ventilation, to become, you know, a pretty smoky place, especially depending on the number of people who are smoking. So the virus being released from an infectious person is very similar to this kind of analogy.
But what does it mean to have good ventilation? Does adding fans count? Miller says no.
Yeah, you don't want to be blowing air around because you can blow virus around if it's suspended in the air. So you want to actually, if it's an occupied space where you're sharing the air with other people, you want to blow the air outside an open window and open some windows. And I think that it's especially difficult in the winter to open some windows, but you know, you do need to have better ventilation when you're sharing the air with people that may or may not be infectious.
In some states where they've been restricted, restaurateurs have cried foul. They say they're being picked on and scapegoated when businesses like grocery stores and big box stores are allowed to run normally. Are those complaints justified?
No, I don't think they are, because the activity that happens in a restaurant or bar is different than what's happening in a store. You know, people can go shopping in a grocery store with a mask on and be pretty socially distant, and they're also moving around the space. When you're in a restaurant or bar, you know, you're staying in one place, you don't have a mask on typically, and you're talking, which generates a lot of aerosol. And so it's the activity and the things that people are doing in that space that cause it to be at higher risk. And that's unfortunately why they are so heavily impacted by this pandemic.
We do have some published data from the MMWR that looks at risk factors for acquiring COVID. And it does seem that the numbers all shake out that there is an enhanced risk of infection among people who have attended events at bars and restaurants. So it's not just a hypothetical risk. I think we've seen that coming out in the data. I certainly think we need to be attentive to the hardship that bars and restaurants are under right now. I don't want to minimize that. But at the same time, I think from a scientific standpoint, they actually do pose different risks. So when people are coming into grocery stores and big box stores, they can wear masks, and there's no reason that they would need to take the masks off while they're shopping. But it's sort of baked into the restaurant and bar experience that you can't do those things while you are still wearing a mask. And so I think that is the piece of it that makes it different and why bars and restaurants are a potential risk, whereas all the other shopping may be less risky.
And how about the precautions restaurants say they've taken, like plexiglass screens? Miller says they help only so far.
They are clearly helpful in very close contact with people because they will limit the spray-borne drop from hitting you in the face, right? But as you move farther away from a person, then they become less effective because airflow goes around these plexiglass barriers quite easily.
Miller says even maintaining a 6-foot distance is no guarantee. In a closed space with poor ventilation and no masks, you can be infected across the room. And that applies to homes as well. So, if Uncle Bob comes to Thanksgiving dinner and he's infected, everyone there is at risk to get the virus and get sick, or to pass it along to someone else. That's why, if you have a Thanksgiving feast at all, Thielen has this advice.
Any gatherings, keep them small for certain. As much as possible, I think keeping things outdoors and then wearing masks when people aren't directly eating. I think those are sort of the key principles. I think it is a time it makes sense, if at all possible, to limit travel and bringing people together from multiple households. I think that definitely increased opportunity for spread amongst different households. And then I think here in Minnesota, it's still quite cold, but I think people are getting creative about ways to be outdoors and really take advantage of the opportunity to disperse the virus, which is what happens in outdoor spaces.
But while gathering in a small group is safer than a large one, it's far from foolproof. Any pod is only as safe as its weakest link.
If you have a pod and it's truly, you know, a couple of households and you're only socializing with each other, I think that is very different from socializing with a pod that also has 10 other pods that they're socializing with. So, you know, I think there's not, you know, in smaller groups, there's not quite the same opportunity for a large magnitude super spreading event. You know, if your group is only 6 people in size, you can't, you know, infect dozens of people like you could in a larger event. But I think there's still that potential for the virus to sort of trickle through the population as there's all these interconnected links.
COVID has proven more devastating than the optimists among us believed at first. More than 240,000 people have died of COVID in the United States. 9.5 million have been infected, and some may be disabled for the rest of their lives. The business and job impact isn't likely to reverse until the virus is stopped. Despite all that, not all of us take it seriously even now. So with their prayers of thanks, experts are hoping this Thanksgiving isn't merely the start of a very bleak winter. I'm Reed Pence.
Coming up, what to do about the flat spot on your baby's head when Radio Health Journal returns.
Hey, it's your homie. Sorry, it's your home. I know you don't like it when I call myself your homie. So I have some favors to ask you. Could you get rid of a few chairs in the living room? My floorboards are tired. Another easy thing, we could save money if you bundled your home and car insurance with Geico. One more thing. I know you love lavender-scented candles, but could we try Tahitian vanilla? I think it would fit my vibe better.
Geico. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Do you think all vitamin Cs are the same? They're not. Ester C is a superior form of vitamin C. It's the only vitamin C with 24-hour immune support, and it lasts up to 2 times longer than regular vitamin C. So don't just settle for any vitamin C. Buy Ester C and support your immune health today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
More than 200,000 newborn babies every year develop a flat spot on their head. And while it may be alarming to many parents, it doesn't need to be. They occur simply because an infant's skull is very soft. So if constant pressure is applied to the same area, it can cause the skull to change shape. That can lead to a condition known as flathead syndrome.
I wouldn't actually even call it a syndrome. It's a deformity of the skull. And in the 1990s, the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with a statement saying that children, babies, should probably sleep on the backs of their heads. And the reason for this is that there was a higher incidence of sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, when kids were either sleeping on their sides or their stomachs. So they felt that kids would be much safer if they slept on the backs. And we've been continuing to do that since the 90s. And the sort of the side effect of that is that kids have come in with flattening either in the central portion of their skull or in the right or left side of the back of the skull.
That's Dr. Peter Tao, professor of pediatrics and neurosurgery at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City.
It can be noticed very early on, such as after the child is born, because there are cases sometimes when the child is either smushed into a strange position in the pelvis and is delivered with some kind of cranial shape abnormality, or it occurs within the first several months of life when the child is sleeping in a crib or on his back in a bassinet, and that softer skull tends to deform somewhat.
Many parents panic when they discover a flat spot on their child's head. Taub says the number one question moms and dads ask is, will my child's brain growth or cognitive function be impacted by a flat spot?
I tell them that no. This should not affect brain development because generally if you're pushing in one portion, there's usually some compensation in the other portion. Most of the consequences are aesthetic, you know, the way the child looks. And a lot of times, a lot of clinicians will sort of just continue observing it. And if it gets better, great. And if there is still some asymmetry, it's probably not going to be too noticeable. Sometimes, you know, babies have very little hair, and you see it very commonly and very easily when the baby's in the shower and the hair is sort of matted against the skull, and you can see a deformity very easily. As children start to grow and their faces develop, the face becomes a major portion of their overall look, and they grow hair, so you see it less as children get older.
But while flat spots are typically just a cosmetic issue that often goes away, many parents want to fix the deformity. One way of doing that is by having the child wear a custom-made helmet.
What a helmet is basically much like a bike helmet. It's a firm shell on the outside with some softer, but still somewhat firm, padding on the inside. And the helmet, the child comes into an orthotist. The orthotist takes some kind of mold or impression, either laser capture or with plaster, a mold of the skull, and a helmet is created from that. That helmet then can be recessed or some of the foam can be taken away in areas where you want the child to grow, and a little bit more foam can be put on where you want a little bit more compression of the areas that are more prominent. So when the child's in the helmet, they're wearing it for about 23 hours a day. Here at Mount Sinai, many of our kids are in the helmet for about 4 to 6 months, and they're allowed to take the helmet off anytime they want. We usually recommend taking it off either for pictures or for bathing, and then getting right back into the helmet.
But before parents say yes to the helmet, it's important for them to consider factors such as cost, upkeep, and potential side effects.
They run about $3,000. in that ballpark. I think many of the insurances cover it. There's a little bit of work that goes into it on the part of the parents. I tell them, unlike a bike helmet, you don't sort of purchase one and leave it alone. This requires going to the orthodontist. You have to fit it, follow up with the orthodontist. Foam may have to be added. Foam may have to be taken away. I mean, this process goes on while the child is wearing that helmet. In the warmer or summer months, kids can get a little bit of a rash. Certainly, most of the time, the helmet gets very smelly and has to be sort of cleaned a little bit. Most of the time, though, kids do perfectly fine with it. Certainly, I think if you are able to sort of keep a child's head off it all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there's some evidence that, you know, that should work, but we can't do that all the time. So a helmet is worn at night, and it prevents that child from sleeping in any one position where you might not allow that head to improve in its shape.
Taub says he prescribes helmets to about 25 to 30% of cases he sees.
When I see parents, I sort of get a sense of the child and how severe the deformity is. And not using hard and fast numbers, I, in my own mind, have a sense of whether this is a sort of a moderate or severe deformity or whether it's a mild deformity. And then the flip side of this is also discussing the case with the parents. Some parents are very traumatized by this, and this is a big, big problem for them. Other parents are very casual about it and don't feel it's a problem at all. So I sort of have to balance the two. So if the child has a sort of a smaller deformity, but the parents are distraught over this, I might lean towards putting that child in a helmet. Conversely, if the child has a sort of little bit more severe deformity, but the parents just aren't bothered by it, they really don't care for the helmet therapy, then we let it go and we see how the child does.
So a helmet may be good for some infants and bad for others, but we can all agree that no one wants to wear a helmet for 23 hours a day. So are there ways to prevent a flat spot in the first place?
The shape of the child's head when they're born is determined by how the child is leaning in the uterus or how they're positioned in the uterus. Once they're delivered, then all of those forces go away. So once the child is born as a newborn, the parent can take very good interest in sort of making sure that the child is not positioned in any one spot or any one direction at any one time. So they can change that child's position, hold the child, make sure that the child sort of rotates from side to side so that they're not leaning in any one position all the time.
So parents play a big role in helping to preserve the shape of their baby's head. But if a flat spot deformity becomes too severe, or parents are troubled by the appearance of their baby's head, Taub says helmet therapy is an effective treatment option. Our writer this week is Hannah Swarm, studio production by Jason Dickey. I'm Nancy Benson.
Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment.
Chemotherapy is the backbone of cancer treatment. However, there are inherent risks associated with compounding and administering intravenous solutions. This concerns some pharmacists, such as Dr. Jeffrey Lombardo of the University at Buffalo, also a spokesperson for Sun Pharma, who welcomes options such as Infugem, gemcitabine in sodium chloride injection, the first and only pre-mixed formulation of this commonly used chemotherapy agent.
Taking proper precautions with compounding is essential to protect the healthcare workers who handle these materials and to ensure that patients receive high-quality chemotherapy at the right dose. Premixed options using engineering controls eliminate accidental exposure to toxic substances that may happen through mixing.
More information is available at Infugem.com. Infugem is contraindicated in patients with a known hypersensitivity to gemcitabine. Infugem can cause increased toxicity with infusion time greater than 60 minutes or dosing more frequently than once weekly. Monitor and, if necessary, discontinue Infugem for myelosuppression, pulmonary toxicity, and respiratory failure. Monitor renal function for hemolytic uremic syndrome and hepatic toxicity. Infugem can cause fetal harm. Advise females and males of reproductive potential to use effective contraception. Advise women using Infugem not to breastfeed. Infugem may cause severe and life-threatening toxicity when administered during or within 7 days of radiation therapy. Discontinue Infugem in case of capillary leak syndrome or posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome. The most common adverse reactions for the single agent are nausea, vomiting, anemia, increased aspartate aminotransferase, increased alanine aminotransferase, neutropenia, increased alkaline phosphatase, proteinuria, fever, hematuria, rash, thrombocytopenia, dyspnea, and edema. Please see full prescribing information at infugem.com/infusion-pi.
Medical notes this week. Parkinson's disease currently has no diagnostic test, so the disorder is often misdiagnosed, but now scientists say they've come up with a simple skin test that can accurately diagnose Parkinson's. According to their study in the journal Movement Disorders, the skin test for clumped proteins was accurate in detecting Parkinson's in 24 out of 25 patients who had it, with only one false positive in 25 patients who did not have the disease. Getting a COVID-19 test is uncomfortable to say the least, with a long swab stuck up into the back of your nose. But a new test could be coming that requires you to simply gargle with a sterile saltwater solution, spit the solution into a specimen cup, and send it off for analysis. A preliminary study in the journal Med Archives shows that the test is not only easier than nasal swab tests, it's also more sensitive without false positives. Between 1 and 5% of children are diagnosed with lazy eye or amblyopia every year. It's a vision disorder where the brain doesn't process inputs from one eye favoring the other and can result in decreased vision in the affected eye. Now a study in the journal Current Biology shows that a single dose of subanesthetic ketamine can treat lazy eye, at least in adults, and help people recover. Subanesthetic ketamine is used to treat depression and pain. And finally, a study that shows how smog generates plastic trash. The study in the journal Nature Human Behavior was done in China before the coronavirus pandemic, and it finds that on smoggy days, office workers are much more likely to order lunch for delivery than they are on pollution-free days. And food delivery is a major source of plastic packaging waste. So it could be that by encouraging food delivery, COVID-19 is doing the same thing. And that's Medical Notes this week. More in a moment.
I'm one of thousands of women with metastatic breast cancer, or MBC.
Which is breast cancer that has spread to other parts of the body.
I'm living in the moment and taking Ibrance, palbociclib.
Ibrance 125 milligram tablets with an aromatase inhibitor is for postmenopausal women or for men with HR-positive, HER2-negative MBC as the first hormonal-based therapy.
Be in your moment. Ask your doctor about Ibrance and visit Ibrance.com.
Patients taking Ibrance can develop low white blood cell counts, which may cause serious infections that can lead to death. Ibrance may cause severe inflammation of the lungs that can lead to death. Tell your doctor right away if you have new or worsening symptoms, including trouble breathing, shortness of breath, cough, or chest pain. Before taking Ibrance, tell your doctor if you have fever, chills, or other signs of infection, liver or kidney problems, are pregnant, breastfeeding, or plan to become pregnant. Common side effects include low red blood cell and low platelet counts, infections, tiredness, nausea, sore mouth, abnormalities in liver blood tests, diarrhea, hair thinning or loss, vomiting, rash, and loss of appetite.
And that's Radio Health Journal for this week. Radio Health Journal is a production of MediaTrax Communications. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more. And check Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify for a library of past programs. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and information about our guests at radiohealthjournal.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.